all year round. Help us raise $25,000 this year. Make your gift today via CFRC.ca.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I just spoke with the Prime Minister of Israel and Lebanon. I'm pleased to announce that their governments have accepted the United States' proposal to end the devastating conflict between Israel and Hezbollah.
Thousands of displaced residents of southern Lebanon are returning home to find scenes of devastation after a ceasefire came into effect earlier today. We'll get the latest, then speak to Israeli journalist Gideon Levy of the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, which has just been sanctioned by the Israeli government as they cut off all communication with the Israeli paper. We'll also speak to ACLU attorney Chase Strangio. Next week, he'll become the first openly trans attorney to argue before the Supreme Court. We'll talk about the case and congressional Republican attacks on Sarah McBride after she was elected as the first openly trans member of Congress. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah has begun. Under the deal, Israel will withdraw troops from South Lebanon over a 60-day period, with Hezbollah moving its fighters and weapons to north of the Litani River. Lebanese troops plan to deploy to the south, which has been largely destroyed by 14 months of Israeli attacks. In a joint statement, the U.S. and France said, quote, "This announcement will create the conditions to restore lasting calm and allow residents in both countries to return safely to their homes," unquote. Thousands of displaced residents of South Lebanon are returning home to find scenes of devastation. On Tuesday, Israel kept bombing the region as well as Beirut until just before the ceasefire took effect. Over the past 14 months, Israel's killed over 3,800 people in Lebanon, displaced more than a million. Israel has not yet urged residents displaced in northern Israel to return to their homes. Many question how long the cessation of hostilities will last. On Tuesday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu threatened to keep attacking Lebanon if Hezbollah violates the deal.
The length of the ceasefire depends on what happens in Lebanon. In full cooperation with the United States, we retain complete military freedom of action. Should Hezbollah violate the agreement or attempt to rearm, we will strike.
In Gaza, Israel struck a school in Gaza City, killing at least 13 displaced Palestinians who'd sought shelter in the Zaytun neighborhood. Dozens were wounded in the attack. An Israeli airstrike on a home in the same neighborhood killed another 7 people. Meanwhile, the United Nations reports this year is already the deadliest on record for aid workers, largely due to Israel's war on Gaza. This is Lisa Doten of the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs.
Since 7 October, more than 330 humanitarian workers have lost their lives. Most of them were UNRWA staff. Some are with their families in their homes. Others were at work in UNRWA offices and shelters. These numbers signal a disturbing lack of regard for the lives of civilians and humanitarian and UN workers. There's no situation in recent history that compares.
President-elect Trump has tapped his former chief economist, Kevin Hassett, to lead the National Economic Council. Hassett helped craft the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which massively redistributed wealth to the richest 1% of Americans, including Trump's family and members of his administration. In 2020, Hassett argued COVID lockdowns should be lifted, predicting zero deaths from the disease by May 15th of that year. In fact, the CDC reported more than 350,000 U.S. COVID deaths in 2020. Meanwhile, Trump has tapped Stanford University health economist Dr. Jay Bhattacharya to lead the National Institutes of Health. In 2020, he was a main author of the Great Barrington Declaration, which argued against COVID lockdowns at a time when no vaccines were available. Instead, Bhattacharya said COVID should be allowed to spread without mitigation in order to create so-called herd immunity. The World Health Organization called the unprecedented plan scientifically and ethically problematic, saying it would result in far more unnecessary infection, suffering, and death. Trump has nominated Jamison Greer to serve as the next U.S. trade representative. During Trump's first term, Greer played a key role in imposing tariffs on China and other nations. He also opened negotiations over the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement, which replaced NAFTA. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum has blasted Donald Trump's pledge to impose a 25% tariff on imports from Canada and Mexico, threatening retaliatory tariffs on U.S. goods. On Tuesday, President Sheinbaum read publicly from her letter to Trump, warning of dire economic consequences if a U.S. trade war, including massive job losses and higher prices on everything from food to electronics to automobiles. Sheinbaum also took aim at Trump's claims of a so-called invasion of asylum seekers at the U.S.-Mexico border, who Trump claims are bringing drugs like fentanyl into the United States.
70% of the illegal weapons seized from criminals in Mexico come from your country. We do not produce these weapons, nor do we consume synthetic drugs. Tragically, it is in our country that people are being killed by crimes resulting from demand in your country.
In Texas, Republican Governor Greg Abbott Tuesday signaled strong cooperation between state and federal law enforcement during a Thanksgiving dinner event in the border town on Edinburgh. Abbott was joined by incoming U.S. Border Czar Tom Homan, who helped serve meals to Texas state troopers and National Guard members. Separately, Texas Land Commissioner Don Buckingham on Tuesday offered the incoming Trump administration the use of up to 13 million acres of Texas land to stage mass deportations. Buckingham spoke from a Starr County ranch in the Rio Grande Valley, where Texas is currently constructing a section of border wall.
I have extended an offer to President Trump and incoming Border Czar Tom Homan to use this 1,400-acre property to construct a facility for the processing, detention, and coordination efforts of what will be the largest deportation of violent criminals in our nation's history.
Meanwhile, U.S. agricultural industry groups are calling on the incoming Trump administration to exempt farm workers from mass deportation, arguing Trump's promise to expel millions of undocumented immigrants from the U.S. would devastate their sector. An estimated 1 million farm, dairy, and meatpacking workers are undocumented. In business news, Walmart, the nation's largest private employer, has announced plans to roll back DEI, that's diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, and close its Center for Racial Equity, which was created after the police killing of George Floyd. In addition, Walmart plans to block third parties from selling certain LGBTQ-themed items on its website. Walmart will also no longer use the terms DEI and Latinx in official communications. The move comes just weeks after Donald Trump was elected after campaigning against DEI initiatives. And news from Pakistan. Security forces in Islamabad arrested over 1,000 protesters in a massive crackdown targeting supporters of jailed former Prime Minister Imran Khan, who'd marched on the capital city. At least 6 people died in the protests that began Sunday. Khan's supporters had vowed to stage a sit-in until he was released, but they ended the protests following the security crackdown. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control says a California child has become the first U.S. minor to become infected with H5N1 bird flu. The source of the infection is not yet known, but investigators do not believe the child had contact with an infected animal. This follows the weeks-long hospitalization of a Canadian teenager in British Columbia who remains critically ill with an H5N1 infection. Viral genome sequences from the teen revealed mutations that might improve the virus's ability to spread among human hosts. H5N1 has spread rapidly through U.S. factory farms, mostly affecting poultry before it was discovered in cattle in March. It's since spread to at least 600 herds and has caused infections in dairy and poultry workers. The California Department of Public Health recently detected H5N1 in a sample of raw milk sold in California. President-elect Trump's nominee for Health Secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., has promised to lift restrictions on unpasteurized milk and has claimed there are no vaccines that are safe and effective. Infectious disease expert Dr. Michael Mina recently wrote bird flu could become the next pandemic, warning, quote, If H5N1 bird flu continues to expand to human transmission, the history books will not look kindly upon the U.S. early efforts to contain it when we absolutely could have taken much more aggressive and clear action, unquote. And lawmakers in the United Kingdom advanced legislation to create a smoke-free generation. Under the Tobacco and Vapes Bill, anyone born after January 1st, 2009 would not be legally allowed to purchase cigarettes. The bill would also ban advertisements promoting vapes and would restrict vapes with flavors that appeal to young people. A recent study predicts tobacco use will cause 300,000 cases of cancer over the next 5 years in the UK alone. On Tuesday, British Health Secretary Wes Streeting argued in favor of the bill during debate in the House of Commons.
Smoking takes 80,000 lives a year, causes one in four deaths from cancer in England, a hospital admission almost every minute, 100 GP appointments an hour. It is the leading cause of sickness, disability, and death in our country. And today, members in this House can consign it to the history books.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Coming up, we look at the new ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah. Stay with us.
يما حاولت تهرب وتناسى السلطان ورميت المرسى بموانع السبع بحار يما كأني بعدني بنفس المكان وجداني وهمومي لسه جوا الدار حاول
I will return, Yo-Yo Ma, Mashu Leila, and Narsi. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Thousands of displaced residents of southern Lebanon are returning home to find scenes of devastation after a ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah came into effect earlier today. In the hours before the cessation of hostilities, Israel repeatedly struck areas of Beirut in southern Lebanon. Under the deal, Israel will withdraw troops from Lebanon's south over a 60-day period, while Hezbollah will move its fighters and weapons to north of the Litani River. Lebanese troops will redeploy to the south. In a joint statement, the U.S. and France said, quote, this announcement will create the conditions to restore lasting calm and allow residents in both countries to return safely to their homes, unquote. Lebanon's caretaker prime minister, Najib Mikati, spoke earlier today.
Truly, it is a new day, concluding one of the most difficult stages of suffering that the Lebanese have experienced in their modern history. It actually was the most harsh as well as hopeful. On this day, the 1,000-mile journey begins to rebuild what was destroyed and to complete strengthening the role of legitimate institutions, at the forefront of which is the army, on which we place great hopes to extend the state's authority over the whole nation and strengthen its presence in the wounded south.
Over the past 14 months, Israel's killed over 3,800 people in Lebanon and displaced more than a million. Israel also killed the entire leadership of Hezbollah, including Hassan Nasrallah and two of his successors. Hezbollah rocket attacks on northern Israel forced tens of thousands of Israelis to flee their homes. We're joined now by two guests. In Tel Aviv, in Israel, we're joined by Gideon Levy. award-winning Israeli journalist, columnist for the newspaper Haaretz, where he's a member of its editorial board. His latest book, The Killing of Gaza, reports on a catastrophe. And in Montreal, Canada, Lina Munzer is with us, Lebanese writer, senior editor of the arts and literature magazine, The Markaz Review. You know, I remember just after the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, Lina, you were in our studio here, and you wrote about what it was like to see an attack on your country from afar, what it meant. Talk about the significance of the ceasefire now.
I mean, of course, you know, it's a welcome relief for the entire country to have this ceasefire. At the same time, it leaves so much devastation behind, you know, and you spoke about in the last hours, the Israelis continued bombing up until, I'm not sure that that conveys the level of barbarism. I mean, they were essentially carpet bombing, you know, the south and Beirut and hitting all kinds of targets and, you know, it absolutely indiscriminately, you know, Israelis always talk about targeted attacks and people buy this, and it's reported even that, you know, when innocent civilians die, it's usually as a collateral damage to these targeted attacks. And of course, there have been targeted assassinations. We've seen them already. The idea that, you know, that civilians are acceptable collateral damage to this kind of targeted assassination is already just a completely outrageous idea. But, you know, yesterday in the final hours of the ceasefire, I had a dear friend who lost his elderly parents. There was absolutely no warning, and they were targeted directly in their apartment. And based on essentially, I suppose, erroneous AI information. And this is something that has happened to countless families over the course of these last 14 months. It was especially difficult. You know, I am in Montreal, but I was speaking to friends throughout the day. I was hearing the airstrikes. People were terrified. People were running on foot. There was absolutely no safe place to hide. It was truly like, you know, at 24 hours that were just condensed horror. And it is absolute terrorism. It is barbarism. I don't have any other words to describe it. And so there's a lot of relief now as we go into the ceasefire. At the same time, there's a lot of apprehension because we're not sure how long it's going to last. It feels like a very fragile truce, essentially. And also, you know, people are coming back not just to devastated homes and devastated lands in the south, but they're picking up the pieces of their lost, you know, families. There are a lot of people now who are going to be able to have funerals that they weren't able to have, memorials that they weren't able to have. You know, the grieving process begins now, not just for the country at large, but specifically for so many families who have lost their loved ones, including up until these final 24 hours. So yes, there is relief, but there's also a lot of apprehension and just an incredible amount of grief, you know. People are finding it very difficult to celebrate. A lot of people that I spoke to just said, I have no energy to do anything today but just sit and cry, you know. So it is, again, very, very mixed feelings around this. But of course, a lot of relief, just at least that the killing is over, because it was just barbaric.
And Lina, what do we know about the terms of this ceasefire or truce? And we've heard from Netanyahu and Biden, but Hezbollah has been silent until now. What do we know about of their perspective?
I think Hezbollah spoke about it earlier. They did not release statements after the U.S. and Israel released their statements. They had spoken earlier just in agreeing essentially to this truce already. So I think that was the statement that they gave, you know, that spoke on their behalf essentially. What we know about, you know, I've heard so many different things about the terms of this truce, and I've read many different things. To be honest, I'm not entirely sure because there's so many contradictory things. But from what I read, yes, there is this idea that the Israelis are now going to withdraw over 60 days their troops. I mean, already people are going flocking to the south to just see the destruction. And the Israelis have been threatening, you know, since yesterday that it's not safe to return to the south. You're not allowed to return until we tell you to return. So already, you know, this idea that there's going to be a restoration of some kind of, you know, Lebanese sovereignty over the land. This is already being contradicted by the behavior and the directives of the Israeli army. And, you know, essentially also what I've read and what I've seen is that Israel has the right to violate Lebanese sovereignty at any moment. So should they decide that there is excuse enough. And, you know, when Israel acts with the impunity that we've seen it act with, and we know that it has the absolute full backing of the United States, it's also very difficult to feel safe as a Lebanese person or to feel that this, the terms of this truce are in any way safe, you know, or in any way provide some sense of security, because you know that at any point they can use any excuse that they like, and it will be accepted. You know, it will be accepted. There's nothing that we can say on the world stage that is going to prevent violation, further violation, further carpet bombing. So there really is a sense of being completely exposed, you know, before the world and having no political recourse, essentially being at the mercy of these larger powers, which, you know, they have demonstrated again and again their brutality over the last 14 months, not just in Lebanon, but much more largely in Gaza.
I want to bring Gideon Levy into this conversation in Tel Aviv. Gideon, if you could start off by responding to, there was a latest text from the Israeli negotiator Gershon Baskin, who wrote, "The ceasefire agreement, which went into effect today, is good news. The agreement is between Israel and the government of Lebanon, not between Israel and Hezbollah. It seems that Hezbollah has been weakened enough." It says, it seems that it's been weakened enough that, let's see if I can find this, that it's been weakened enough to end the war in Lebanon before the war in Gaza has ended. Your response to this, and also the response in Israel right now to, I think it was about 4 a.m. that the ceasefire or the cessation hostilities went into effect.
Yes, I wish I could tell you that Israel is happy about the ceasefire. I wish I could tell you that there is even a relief in Israel. But unfortunately, in Israel, everyone, almost everyone, is critical about this agreement. I guess many Israelis did not have enough. For sure, the right-wingers, for sure, the most of the inhabitants of the north, they would like to see more blood and more destruction in Lebanon. And therefore, they are so sour today. And the other camp, as usual, is saying nothing. And even one of the opposition leaders, Benny Gantz, even criticized the ceasefire. He thought the war should go on. In other words, Israel wants wars. That's the inevitable conclusion when you see reactions to a ceasefire which puts an end, at least partial end, to suffer in both sides, suffer which didn't lead to anywhere. Israel didn't achieve anything in this war. It will not achieve anything in the war in Gaza, 10 times or 1,000 times worse. And here I must emphasize that nobody should have any illusions. Netanyahu has no intention to put an end to the war in Gaza. What happened in Lebanon will not happen soon in Gaza, because if he goes for an agreement in Gaza, he loses his government, and that's his top priority. And Israel, at least part of Israel, has very serious intentions to resettle Gaza. Don't underestimate those settlers. The sky's the limit for them. They just wait for Donald Trump to get into the office. And I will not be surprised if we'll very soon later see settlements in Gaza. In other words, nothing was solved yesterday except of the punishment of Lebanon, which came to its end. But also this is for a very limited time. I mean, when the prime minister speaks about the agreement and all he has to say are threats about Lebanon and Hezbollah, that if any violation will take place, immediately Israel will attack again. So we are going from one war to the other. and from one violent confrontation to the other without even suggesting any other alternative. Nothing. Nobody speaks about diplomacy. Nobody speaks about touching the core issues, both in the North and in the South. Our friend from Lebanon, our Lebanese friend, just mentioned violations of the sovereignty of Lebanon. Anyone speaks about the fact that Israel, I'm sure, will continue to fly over Lebanon for intelligence. This will be kosher. This will be legitimate. And only the violation of Israeli sovereignty is never forgiven.
And Gideon Levy, I wanted to ask you, in terms of the toll on the IDF now, over 800 soldiers have been killed in Gaza. About the estimates are about 73 or 74 in Lebanon, and those are the only ones publicly acknowledged. What is the impact on Israel of continuing this war on the economy of Israel, on migration, on tourism, and the other aspects of economic life in Israel?
The price is enormous, but somehow Israeli accepted. This is this unbelievable phenomena in which people are ready to sacrifice the dearest ones. I mean, who is more than your son? Without seeing a real purpose. I mean, they all tell themselves that they were killed, sacrificed for the defense of Israel. But what kind of defense is it if you bomb a camp in Gaza? What does Israel benefit out of it? The economical price is one thing. I mean, you mentioned tourism. There is no tourism whatsoever. There are hardly any international airlines to fly in here. But there is a much heavier price, namely turning Israel into a pariah state. You know it very well from the United States, but everywhere else. It's not only that Netanyahu and the Gallant are now wanted all over the world. Every Israeli will feel it when he will go abroad now. Every Israelis everywhere will feel at least discomfort in the presenting himself, identifying himself as an Israeli. And still Israelis are ready to take this only because they were told that we have to live from war, to live on our sword, and there is no other option, which is a total lie because Israel never tried an alternative. But brainwash like brainwash.
Gideon, I don't know if you can respond to this, but the Israeli cabinet has unanimously voted to sanction your paper, Haaretz, saying its editorials, quote, have hurt the legitimacy of the state of Israel and its right to self-defense, unquote. Under the move, the Israeli government will stop advertising in the paper, cut off all communications with Haaretz. Haaretz has slammed the decision, saying it, quote, is another step in Netanyahu's journey to dismantle Israeli democracy. Like his friends Putin, Erdogan, Orban, Netanyahu is trying to silence a critical independent newspaper. Haaretz will not balk and will not morph into a government pamphlet that publishes messages approved by the government and its leader. Unquote. This all comes 6 months after Israel banned Al Jazeera from operating in Israel. And as the president-elect here in the United States, Donald Trump threatens to go after major U.S. broadcasters and publications, calling the media the enemy of the people. Gideon, you serve on the editorial board of Haaretz. I know you can't speak specifically about the sanctions against your paper, but can you talk broader about these threats to the press?
Sure. It's not that I can't, but we decided that this message that you just read now is our reaction as a newspaper. But I think that those sanctions tell much more about Israel and Israel's government than about Haaretz. And here, I think especially in the United States, who always speaks about the shared values, about the only democracy in the Middle East. So, first of all, it's questionable if a state which rules in such a brutal way in 5 million people can at all be defined as a democracy. But let's put the occupation and the apartheid aside. Even for us Jews in Israel, who used to live in a quite liberal democracy, things are changing right now, from day to day, from week to week, legislations against freedom of speech, against the legal system, against any kind of human rights, against any minority are being ruled, and nobody says a word. I mean, nobody can stop it, at least as long as this government is there. So what I would like to stress here, Amy, is that you have to also look at what's going on within the Jewish Israel. It is changing while we are speaking. And the war in Gaza and Lebanon has a lot to do with it, because those two wars, with all their lack of legitimacy and brutality, also influence the domestic structure and the domestic system of Israel, and you see the outcome. I don't take my freedom of speech, and I have speech, total freedom of speech, but I can't take it for granted anymore.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. And I want to give Lena Munzer, just we have 30 seconds, but the last word on what you expect to happen from here as you watch what has happened to your country, at least for this moment, from afar.
Look, we're very terrified of the day after. Mr. Levy talked about the effect on internal Israeli politics. We're also very afraid. Lebanon is a very fragile, you know, pluralist state. But at the same time, the Israelis also have known very much how to work on that. So they've been specifically bombing where the refugees have gathered. We've seen over the last few months that people have been turning away refugees. These refugees are largely Shia from South Lebanon and from the southern suburbs of Beirut. So there's been a lot of hostility that has incurred. So we're really, really afraid of the day after in terms of, you know, the internal stability of the country and what's going to happen to it. And I just want to say, you know, to go back to this idea of collateral damage, this is something that the United States normalized, you know, in our region, in Iraq, the way to punish an entire country in order to change some sort of internal mechanism, which then devastates the country because, of course, they have no idea what they're doing. And this is not how you bring about change. So we're all also very afraid of now what's going to happen to Lebanon internally as we go on. And as the pieces are picked up and a lot of anger and recrimination is going to start coming to the surface among the population. So, you know, as we say in Arabic, Allah yustur, like we have no idea what's going to happen.
Lena Munzer, we want to thank you for being with us. Lebanese writer and senior editor of the arts and literature magazine, The Markaz. And Gideon Levy, award-winning Israeli journalist at Haaretz, author of the new book, The Killing of Gaza, Reports on a Catastrophe. We thank you so much both for joining us from Montreal and from Tel Aviv. Coming up, we speak to ACLU attorney Chase Strangio. Next week, he will become the first openly trans attorney to argue a case before the U.S. Supreme Court. Stay with us.
It's been too long trying to get along, giving you what you want. Now I know without a doubt who to be like. I won't let nobody tell me how to. There are many roads, there are many ways. I won't let nobody tell me. I won't let nobody tell me how to be like. I won't let nobody tell me how to. There are many ways, there are many ways.
By Clarity featuring Claro. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. When incoming Republican President Donald Trump returns to office, he's vowed to target the LGBTQIA community. Our next guest will be a key figure in challenging this. Next week, Chase Strangio will make history as the first openly transgender lawyer to make oral arguments before the Supreme Court as the justices consider Tennessee's ban on gender-affirming hormone therapies for transgender minors. The case argues the ban is a form of sex discrimination. Last week, the Republican House Speaker, Mike Johnson, announced a policy banning transgender people from using some Capitol restrooms that correspond to their gender. This came after Republican Congressmember Nancy Mace introduced a resolution to ban transgender women from using women's restrooms at the Capitol, then posted about it more than 300 times in just a matter of a few days on social media. This follows the election of Delaware Democrat Sarah McBride as the first openly transgender Congress member. McBride dismissed the Capitol bathroom bans as a distraction during a recent interview on CBS.
Some members of the small Republican conference majority decided to get headlines and to manufacture a crisis.
Chase Strangio joins us now, co-director of the American Civil Liberties Union's LGBTQ and HIV Project. In a week, again, he becomes the first openly transgender lawyer to argue a case before the Supreme Court, looking at Tennessee. Welcome to Democracy Now! There's a lot to discuss here. Why don't we begin with this case in which you're going to make history?
Well, good to see you, Amy. Thank you for having me. We are before the Supreme Court at this moment when transgender people are under so much scrutiny. And this comes on the tail of 24 states banning evidence-based medicine for transgender adolescents. And that is why we are before the Supreme Court now. One of those states is Tennessee. Tennessee has categorically banned medical treatment for adolescents only when that treatment is prescribed in a manner that Tennessee considers inconsistent with a person's sex. So what we're arguing before the Supreme Court is that, look, this is a simple example of sex discrimination. Our clients, so if you take, for example, a transgender adolescent boy, he cannot receive testosterone to live consistent with his male identity because he was assigned female at birth. Had he been assigned male at birth, he could receive that same medication for that same purpose. That is sex discrimination, and Tennessee has to justify it, which the district court concluded that Tennessee just simply did not. The courts across the country that have actually looked at the evidence have repeatedly found that the claims about the harms of this treatment just do not hold up to even the slightest bit of scrutiny. But of course, we lost in the appellate court. We're now before the Supreme Court making the case that this is just a plain and simple example of sex discrimination. And the fact that it's sex discrimination against trans people doesn't make it any less unconstitutional.
And Chase, this comes in the in a period when the Republican Party used anti-trans ads throughout the presidential campaign. I'm wondering your reaction to the impact of those ads around the country.
Yeah, it is astonishing to think about $250 million that have been spent focused on a group that represents less than 1% of the population. I think it comes out to, you know, almost $100 to $200 per trans person in the United States. And obviously, there's sort of two fundamental things that happen as a result of those ads. The first is just the impact on trans people are ourselves. We are living in a climate in which we are being demonized, in which we are being blamed for structural failures of this country. I talk about scapegoating if you're blaming trans people for everything from changes in education to school shootings, to changing gender norms across the board. So that's one aspect of this. And then the other is that this rhetoric, and I will say the post-election legitimizing of it by Democrats, is what creates the policy realities that we're living under. The policy realities where you have 550 anti-trans bills introduced in a single year, resulting in the stripping away of healthcare that people rely on, resulting in Representative Mace targeting transgender people's ability to access restrooms in federal buildings. This is a cascading reality of material harm for our community on top of the rhetorical and cultural harms that it is bestowing upon us.
I want to play a clip from one of Trump's presidential campaign TV ads for those who didn't see it. This particular one with transphobic messaging that aired, I think it was over 15,000 times.
KAMALA supports taxpayer-funded sex changes for prisoners.
Surgery.
For prisoners.
For prisoners. Every transgender inmate in the prison system would have access.
Hell no, I don't want my taxpayer dollars going to that.
KAMALA supports transgender sex changes in jail with our money.
KAMALA even supports letting biological men compete against our girls in their sports. KAMALA is for they, them. President Trump is for you.
I'm Donald J. Trump, and I approve this message.
KAMALA is for they, them. Donald Trump is for you. And yesterday, KAMALA HARRIS spoke, and a bunch of the senior members of her staff spoke out on Pod Save America. And a lot of the discussion in that conversation was about how they dealt with these ads. I'm very interested, Chase, as you say, that you are faulting the Democrats and how they're dealing with this, that they are normalizing this. Explain.
Well, so it's not even that they're normalizing it. What they're saying is that the Harris campaign did too much to support trans people, which is a hard pill to swallow since they did nothing. You know, KAMALA HARRIS did not respond to the ads. She did not make any affirmative statements in support of trans people throughout the...
I mean, that's very interesting because apparently they floated the ad first, the Republicans, to see if there would be a response. When there was dead silence, they just went for it.
And yeah, so they went for it. And then in the aftermath of the election, you have this postmortem in which you have Democrats, you know, pundits as well as politicians speaking out and saying, well, part of why the Harris campaign lost is because they were too supportive of trans people. But what did they do? Nothing. And so the obvious, you know, takeaway from that is, well, they should have just joined in the attacks. They should have said, yes, it is. Of course we should exclude trans girls from sports. Of course we should deny people in government custody of medical treatment. These are constitutional norms that they are sensationalizing because and playing into people's misunderstanding about trans people and our bodies. And they played on that misinformation and they played on that fear in a campaign that was both about trans people and also about gender more broadly. And what trans people represented in that was the instability of gender roles that were causing so much anxiety. I mean, that's why you saw Vice President-elect Vance talking about the role of postmenopausal women is to care for children. Childless cat ladies, are whatever else he said about that, to demonize people who aren't playing the proper gender roles. It wasn't just about trans people. Trans people were a very specific focus, but this was a broader commentary on an approach to gender that is regressive and dangerous for everyone.
And Chase, in your arguments on the Tennessee case before the Supreme Court, what do you, especially given the large conservative majority on this court, what will you be looking for in terms of the kinds of questions that the justices will ask, or what hope you might have of swaying some of the conservative justices?
Yeah, so, you know, at the end of the day, this really is a simple argument about a law that tells us 10 times over on its face that it's about sex. It says you can't do something if it's inconsistent with your sex. And Tennessee comes in and says, well, that's not really about sex. But that sounds a lot like the arguments that the employers raised in the case of Bostock, where the question was, is it because of sex to fire someone for being transgender? And that was a conservative majority court that said 6-3 that is because of sex. That if you are firing someone because they are transgender, that means you are firing someone assigned male at birth because they identify as a woman. And you are not firing someone assigned female at birth because they identify as a woman. The same is true here. We're making that same argument. We think it is as clear in this context as it was in Bostock. And our hope is that the cultural anxiety about trans people, the demonization of our healthcare, is not going to sway the justices from applying straightforward constitutional principles that have been applied for 50 years.
So You're arguing this case. This is unusual, isn't it? Alongside the Biden administration.
So it is not totally unusual. You often have a situation where private parties will bring a case and the United States will intervene, or the United States can weigh in at the Supreme Court as amicus. What is a little bit unusual here is that you really have us as co-equal parties in this case. We are splitting the time with the Solicitor General going first, and I will go after her, and making this argument, both of us, that this is a law that violates the Equal Protection Clause, and that the court, if it is going to faithfully apply its precedents that say that when a government it discriminates based on sex, that it is the government's burden. It's Tennessee's burden to show that the statute that they've passed is constitutional, and they have failed to do that. So we are in it together up until January 20th.
And then what happens? I mean, is there any possibility that this wouldn't happen by January 20th? And then the Trump administration would not be there next to you.
So that's absolutely right. We fully expect the Trump administration to switch positions. That is not unusual also. There will be other cases in which the administration switches positions. This case was originally brought by the transgender adolescents and their parents, who we represent, against the Tennessee officials who are charged with enforcing this law that bans their health care. The parties will still be there. There's no reason why the court would in any way be stripped of jurisdiction. So we move forward past January 20th. It's up to the Supreme Court, of course, what happens next.
I want to go back to what's happened in these last few days in Congress. Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson speaking to reporters last week after South Carolina Congress member Nancy Mace introduced this resolution to ban transgender women from using women's restrooms at the Capitol after the election of Delaware Congress member Sarah McBride, the first openly trans Congress member. This is what he said.
Can you talk about the policy that you just issued?
Yeah, I'm not sure what more there is to say.
Is it enforceable?
Yeah, like all House policies, it's enforceable. But we have single-sex facilities for a reason, and women deserve women's only spaces. And we're not anti-anyone. We're pro-woman. And I think it's an important policy for us to continue. It's always been an unwritten policy, but now it's in writing.
So it's an unwritten policy, but now it's in writing. This is the House Speaker, Republican Johnson. And I wanted to ask you about Nancy Mace, this campaign she is on. But it is new. Last year, in 2023, Congressmember Mace, during an interview with CBS News, proclaimed she was, quote, pro-transgender rights and pro-LGBTQ. Now she's putting up little paper signs that say biological above the signs that say women's room.
Yeah, so I think one thing to keep in mind is that the cultural discourse and the popular culture norms shift what happens in law and policy. If you look at the tenor of the conversations in this country, it's shifted so far against trans people that now we have proposed bans on trans people using restrooms in all public buildings. A few years ago, let's say in 2019, the question of trans people in restrooms had really died out. It was something where the proponents of those bans admitted that all of their claims were fabricated, that there was no evidence that there was any harm or violence by allowing trans people to use restrooms that align with who they are, which of course they do. We do all the time. And this idea that there is some unwritten rule in which people are surveilled out of restrooms is just simply not true. It is not enforceable, as we know. But this escalation is a product of the ways in which our public discourse has shifted so dramatically around gender and around trans people.
Are you nervous about next week? You are making history, Chase.
You know, of course I'm nervous. I'm nervous because I am always nervous to do right by my community. And the stakes are so high. This argument is happening in the period of time after the election, before the inauguration, a time when trans people are feeling so vulnerable, a time when, you know, I hear every single day from parents who are asking me if they have to leave the United States. And so that is what I'm carrying with me. I'm nervous for December 4th. I'm nervous for 2025. We don't know what we're up against, but I guess the two things I'll say are that, one, this case is a fight to put a limit on what government officials can do to target trans people across the board, and we are going to fight with everything that we have. And then the other thing I'll say specifically to the trans community, to the people who love trans people, is we have always resisted. We have always taken care of each other. No matter what happens, that is what we'll do.
Jay Strangio. On December 4th, he becomes the first openly transgender attorney to argue a case before the U.S. Supreme Court. Chase is co-director of the American Civil Liberties Union's LGBTQ and HIV Project. We thank you so much for being with us. We hope to talk to you after you make your arguments. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show in Pakistan, where security forces in Islamabad arrested over 1,000 protesters in a massive crackdown targeting supporters of jailed former Prime Minister Imran Khan during a march on the capital city. At least 6 people died in the protests that began Sunday. Khan's supporters had vowed to stage a sit-in until he was released, but they ended the protest following the security crackdown, which has been described by Khan's supporters as a massacre. Imran Khan has been in prison since August 2023 on what are widely viewed as politically motivated charges. We're joined right now by Asim Sajjad Akhtar. He is Associate Professor of Political Economy at Khed-e-Azam University in Islamabad. He's also affiliated with Pakistan's left-wing Awami Workers Party. Thanks so much for being with us, Professor. If you can just start off by talking about what took place in the last few days. Now, Imran Khan supporters have called off the protests, but the mass protest has taken place and the number of arrests and deaths.
Yes, thanks, Amy. Well, I mean, some of your viewers will know that this is a long simmering conflict between the PTI, which is Imran Khan's party, and the present government. It has many phases. The most recent sort of big sort of part of this sort of conflict was in February of 24, when in general elections, it's widely sort of understood that Khan's party won the majority of seats, but through various kinds of post-poll rigging, was denied an opportunity to run the government. And this was while Khan was in jail, and he's been in jail now for, I think, 14 months. So this protest, which was called on the 24th of November, was yet another sort of big mass mobilization to demand his release, to demand the release of many other PTI leaders and supporters who have been in and out of prison both before and during this protest, and to basically say, or to demand, in a sense, that this, what the PTI believes, and what I think is reasonable for it to believe, is an illegitimate government, is called to account, and sort of polls are held afresh. And what transpired, as you noted, was a crackdown. Despite the crackdown, mind you, the PTI and its supporters managed to get into the city of Islamabad and all the way to what is called the D-Chowk, which is right close to a series of government buildings, including the parliament. But then late last night, they were pushed back after a lot of, well, initially skirmishes and then serious repression. And right now, we don't actually know the extent of how many people have lost their lives, how many people are injured, because a lot of that is being blanked out by the state media.
And Professor Akhtar, to what do you attribute the mass popularity of Imran Khan, and also this whole question that some of his supporters have raised that he ran afoul of the United States when he was in office?
Well, I mean, Imran Khan is a phenomenon that has many parallels around the world, sort of a self-proclaimed outsider who I think has built his popularity around the unpopularity of the so-called liberal centrist parties, or what we would call the liberal establishment, which has over many, many decades now acceded to, for instance, IMF conditionalities, have allowed the military, which of course is Pakistan's most prominent and powerful political force, a free hand. And so, you know, all of these things, and there was a war on terror in Afghanistan and its effects in Pakistan. And Khan sort of pitched himself as an outsider, as an anti-establishment outsider who wanted to change the system. He came to power, as some of your viewers will know, and was in power for the best part of 4 years between 2018 and 2022. And when he fell afoul of the military, initially his coming to power was largely assisted by the military, but fell afoul of the military in 2022 is when he was booted out. But people like Imran, I think, are in a sense, you know, are able to play to their gallery better when they're out of power. And so the last couple of years, anti-incumbency, with whether it be because of inflation, unemployment, again, you know, a regime that is pandering to the military at every juncture, I think that has, in a sense, it further inflated this support base that Khan enjoys. In a very youthful country, mind you, Pakistan's median age is about 23. And as far as the America thing goes, I don't think there's any conclusive evidence that there was sort of direct meddling in that particular decision for Khan to be booted out in April 2022. That was largely because he fell afoul of the military. But again, as your viewers will know, this is not a country in which the United States needs to intervene at any one juncture. It's had a larger-than-life role, partly in sponsoring and propping up Pakistan's military since the Cold War. So the fact that, you know, Khan touches a nerve by speaking about American involvement, I think also speaks to how you can take a particular grain of truth and sort of combine it with mass anti-incumbency to generate a great deal of resentment.
And you mentioned the Pakistani military. Could you talk about the outsized role of the military within Pakistani society? And are there the long-established ties between it and the U.S. military?
That's right. Yes, as I said, this is a story that goes all the way back to the Cold War. Pakistan was widely viewed by the Washington as a anti-communist frontline state through the 1950s, 60s, and then most notoriously after 1977, when the so-called jihad was backed by America and sort of, in a sense, operationalized by the Pakistani military. And then again, when that story turned on its head and the old jihadis were now cast as terrorists after 2001, again, it was a military dictatorship of Pervez Musharraf, which was backed heavily by the Bush administrations, and even later on by the Obama administration. So there's a long story, and the Pakistani military has benefited from American support to not only dominate Pakistan's political life, but also largely dominate its economy. And I think what has happened with Khan, because as I noted earlier, Khan actually initially came to power with the support of the military. But what has happened is that this long sort of gestating, simmering sort of undercurrent of sentiment amongst ordinary people about the outsized, as you said, role of the military in Pakistan's political, economic, and social life, I think there it is coming to a head somewhat. Now, time will tell, however, whether Khan and his party are really able and willing to take on the military and sort of the militarized political economy, as I would say, rather than perhaps just seeking a route back into power. But that doesn't excuse, of course, the fact that they have been subject to serious repression over the last couple of years, and I think that has simply reinforced Khan's massive popularity.
So do you see parallels between Imran Khan, who can, you know, as you say, mobilize massive number of people from prison into the streets, even as so many are arrested and a number killed? Do you see parallels between him, who faces a number of corruption charges, and President Trump?
Yeah, as I noted earlier, I mean, he is, as I said, Imran is a symbol of the type of political leader that has emerged, I think, over the last 15, 20 years. Trump is another example. Right next door to us in India is Modi. I mean, there's many such examples, sort of this so-called new outsider who perhaps really isn't as much of an outsider as the narrative would suggest, that builds upon, as I said, the resentment, the disillusionment of the liberal establishment of people with established parties and with the establishment at large. And certainly there's parallels. In fact, Trump and Imran, when they were both in their earlier incarnations in office in 2019, sort of had this very buddy-buddy type engagement when they met. And right now, right after your election on November 5th, There was a lot of PTI online sort of media, mind you. A lot of the PTI has a great deal of support in the diaspora that sort of played up this notion that maybe a Trump administration would coax the Pakistani military into getting Imran out of power. So there's a lot of parallels. They're not the same thing. They can't be reduced to the same thing, but I do think that it tells us a lot about how the liberal center continues to fail and pave the way for these so-called outsiders to thrive.
Asim Sajjad Akhtar, we thank you so much for being with us, Associate Professor of Political Economy at Qaidi Azam University in Islamabad. That does it for our show. Tune in Thursday, Thanksgiving, for a special broadcast with Indigenous scholar Nick Estes and Ta-Nehisi Coates, author of The Message. And on Friday, we'll speak to Namati Nenkimo, an Indigenous leader from the Amazon in Ecuador, as well as Palestinian poet Masab Abu Toha from Gaza. That does it for our show. Special thanks to Mike Berkerney Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nodura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Happy holidays.
The Museum of Lenox in Addington invites you to join them over the holidays celebrating Friday Night Lights on Friday, November 29th, December 6th, and December 13th. Stop by the museum between 5 to 8 p.m. each night for a free visit, live music, open galleries, festive crafts with local artists in the Creation Corner, shopping in the museum gift shop, and a special museum kids holiday shop where kids can shop for $2 gifts and have their presents wrapped. Plus, attendees can also enjoy an immersive seasonal candlelit play, House Guest, created by and starring Kingston-based Emerging Actors and Dance School of Drama and Music University students. Advance tickets are $10. Details at countymuseum.ca.